One woman's call to action today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Sunitha Krishnan founded a group in India that helps women escape sex trafficking or slave labor. What made her an activist? Her own sexual assault.
People spoke about me as if I was responsible for what happened to me.
We'll hear from Sunitha Krishnan and from former U.S. diplomat Samantha Power on what it takes to really empower women.
It's not as simple as, you know, as someone once said, women in binders and, you know, plucking people out. It's about pipelines. It's about educating girls and creating a sense of possibility for them.
Plus, the story behind this memorable moment on Jeopardy.
We come to Lily Chin and her response, "Who is the spiciest meme lord?"
Those stories today, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us this Monday. We're going to start the show today with a close look at a global problem that many people would prefer not to talk about, sex trafficking. And we're about to meet someone who has devoted her career to helping women and children escape it. Sunitha Krishnan is the founder of Prajvala, a nonprofit in Hyderabad, India, that seeks out those trafficked into a life of prostitution or forced labor and then brings them to shelters. The aim is to help ease victims into a new life. In the first part of the show today, we're also going to hear from Samantha Power, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Power has followed Krishnan's work closely, and she helped select her as a finalist for the Aurora Prize, a global humanitarian award. First, though, Sunitha Krishnan's backstory. And a heads up here, some of the details in her story are disturbing, starting with a traumatic event she experienced as a teenager that profoundly changed her life.
I was 15 when I was gang raped by 8 men, and you know, I don't like to recollect too much about the rape per se, but what lingered with me then, and it lingers with me till date, is the entire unfairness of the whole thing, where I was blamed for a crime that I did not commit. I was blamed for getting raped by 8 men. I was socially excluded. I was rejected by my community. And people spoke about me as if I was responsible for what happened to me. I think that anger in me was my driving factor. And it is that anger in me that has brought me till here, where I am now. It triggered the first thoughts of doing something for women and children who are subjected to sex crime. And then as I went ahead in that thought, I thought women and children in sex slavery are the worst lot. You know, a rape or a gang rape is a one-time incident, but sex slavery is about everyday rape. Any girl in a brothel in India gets raped 40 to 50 times a day, for weeks together, months together, years together before she is rescued, and hardly 7% of them get ever rescued. So my journey started with a transformative incident, because if not for that incident, I wouldn't have got the direction that I've got today.
It is unimaginable, but there was another pivotal event in your formative years in 1995 when you were arrested. You were protesting the 1995 Miss World contest in Bangalore. You spent some time in jail, and then you went through a different sort of social rejection. Tell us about that and what that did.
Going to the jail, I realized what it means to be physically rejected by everybody. I was arrested for protesting against the Miss World pageant, and I was arrested with around 12 more women. And for my family, who at the age of 15, when I was gang raped, definitely, it was very difficult for them to understand, very difficult for them to fathom what was happening to me. But there was this kind of a silent support. You emotionally exclude somebody, but, you know, you're physically still with all of them. So it's like a cold war within the same walls inside. But for the first time I faced when I went to the jail, that they refused to come to the jail to see me. I didn't have a change of clothes, because nobody would come to see me actually in the jail to give me a pair of clothes to change. And I think that was my first lessons in understanding the constituency of human beings that I work with today, Today, when I meet my children and women who are rejected by the world, their families reject them, the community rejects them, they don't get a job anywhere, they don't get a school admission anywhere because they were in a brothel. Everybody wants somebody to care for them. Everybody wants to belong somewhere. So today, the kind of shelter homes that I've created, which is one of the largest in the world, you know, every process in the shelter home is about reaffirming a million ways that, you know, you belong here, we care for you, and we are there for you. You know, I know what it means to have people saying, we just don't want you in our lives.
Today, how are relations between you and your family?
I think today they are extremely proud of what I am. Not that they understand so much. They don't understand the various choices that I have made. I have chose to be a full-time volunteer in my mission. They don't understand that. They don't understand my madness in terms of risking my life. I've been assaulted, physically assaulted more than 17 times. So they're not able to understand any of that. But all these international recognitions that has come by, more than it means to me, it means a lot to them. So today, at least, they know that, you know, they don't need to be ashamed of a daughter like me.
Ambassador Power, I know you're well acquainted with Sunita Krishnan's work. What strikes you about what she does, and why did you think it was important to champion her cause?
Well, I think that we are living in dark times globally. There's a huge regression when it comes to democracy, even among established democracies, like that in India, like that in the United States. And yet there are people like her who are putting their lives on the line, really risking everything to try to make their societies better. And I think, you know, in our own circumstances, it can be tempting to get depressed and to turn off. And yet when you hear a story like hers, I mean, at any point, whether at the age of 15 or right to the present day, having been physically assaulted, having been jailed, having been shunned, she just keeps fighting to try to make things better in her own community and for people more vulnerable than she now finds herself.
So let me switch gears a bit, but not really, and ask both of you, with the Me Too movement becoming more vocal and more stories emerge by the day, on the global front, are governments and international organizations feeling that heat, or are they often acting as roadblocks to women's empowerment? Ambassador Power.
When I was at the United Nations until January 2017, for the last 2 years of my time sitting on the UN Security Council, I was the only woman ambassador out of 15. And so every day, school tours were coming into the United Nations Security Council chamber, that sort of famous horseshoe table. And the little girls, little boys were looking down, thinking, oh, there's where peace is made or not made, you know, depending on the day. And look, 14 of the 15 people responsible for trying to make the world better in this institution are male. And that creates a sense of what's normal. Today, you know, a couple of years later, there are two women who sit on the Security Council. The United States and the United Kingdom are the only two represented by women. And the same is true, you know, within the U.S. government. The same, I'm sure Sunita can describe, is true within Indian institutions, you know, at all levels. And this is a global phenomenon. Mm. And it's not as simple as, you know, as someone once said, women in binders and, you know, plucking people out. It's about pipelines. It's about educating girls and creating a sense of possibility for them and a sense of entitlement for them from a very early stage. So I think girls' education, mentoring, and then now with the Me Too movement, also making them feel as if they have nothing to be ashamed of if they have been abused, if they have been assaulted, to make very clear, and I think that's what's so important about this last year or two, to make very clear who actually deserves to feel shame in light of these crimes and in light of this harassment and intimidation that is being perpetrated worldwide.
Sunita Krishnan, how do you see this in India? Is the government there feeling the heat of the Me Too movement?
My greatest problem in our country is that our government moves only when something outraging happens. Hundreds of children are getting raped everywhere, you know, and they don't get the same kind of outrage. There are certain incidents that get a lot of highlight, and the government responds to that. So the danger in that kind of thing is that there's a lot of populist kind of approach You want to just please and pacify the masses, and you do something so that everybody is like, now, okay, pacified. But you don't do anything to, you know, clean the system. You don't do anything to ensure that the criminal justice system is victim friendly. As a woman or a child, I cannot even enter a court because the courts are so hostile. There's hardly, you know, there are just a handful of child-friendly courts in India. How does a child go to a court, you know, when the courts are so hostile? And a case can be pending in the courts for years together. I had this little one, 9-year-old, who went to the court 3 times to testify, and all the 3 times it was adjourned. Now, this is just a 9-year-old child. How many years are we supposed to keep her motivated that, yes, you have to fight and you have to testify? So the entire system, the structures down there, are completely hostile to victims. So it is not just about saying, okay, we care for you. But if you care for victims, then you make systems conducive for them. You create an enabling environment for victims to come forward and speak. The entire criminal justice system is hostile to the victim. So until and unless all those things don't change, I don't see any big impact of a movement like Me Too, because even if I want to report, I'm unable to report because the very journey ahead is so scary.
So it's interesting, you work, both of you, in such different spheres, activism and diplomacy, but you also have in some ways many of the same goals. I'd love to know, what is the one thing that each of you would like the other to keep in mind? And let me start with Sunita.
I think if women are recognized as a central in every thought process, in every development plan, in every peace process, in every security process anywhere in the world, and very specifically the UN, and women have a say in that process, I think that would be a very big game changer in the world.
And Ambassador Power.
Maybe what I will say is maybe a little more controversial. I started my career as a critic, as somebody on the outside of powerful institutions like the U.S. government or the United Nations, and then went in because I met Barack Obama and worked with him in the Senate and then joined his campaign, and suddenly found myself working at the White House and having a badge and a security clearance. And, you know, that created some tension sometimes with my former activist friends, as I would sometimes have to defend policies or found myself defending policies that they didn't always agree with. I guess what I would say is, I think for all of us now on the outside where I find myself again, it's important to remember that institutions are made of individuals, and individuals in too many cases are indifferent, and in some cases, even in very repressive places, are malicious or are excluding whole communities or whole genders, you know, from consideration or from care. But often, if you look hard enough within even institutions that are not doing nearly enough or even doing bad things, you can find individuals who are kindred spirits. And so I guess for myself, I have to remember this now that I'm back on the outside, pretty frustrated by the policies of my government and by those of many governments around the world, but also for all my activist friends. It's how do we look within these big behemoth, you know, often impenetrable institutions and find people who bring a like-minded spirit and who really want to make the societies that they work in better.
We've been speaking with Samantha Power, who served as the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. under President Obama. Also with Sunita Krishnan, the co-founder of Prajwala, an India-based group that helps victims of sex trafficking. She's one of 3 finalists for the Humanitarian Aurora Prize. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on the show after the break, how the immigrant spirit influenced the spiciest meme lord on Jeopardy. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We talk on the show a lot about the immigrant spirit, that grit that people new to America seem to have to succeed. I know that sounds like the contours of many a Hollywood screenplay, but lots of kids of immigrants say they've caught that spirit, and today there are more kids of immigrants in America than ever before. The World's Rupa Shenoy has one example of how a second-generation immigrant spirit is shaping modern American culture, including a staple of mainstream TV, Jeopardy.
Getting on Jeopardy! Isn't just about being smart. Lily Chin learned that the first time she auditioned. Everyone has to do an interview with producers. Chin was auditioning for a spot in the show's college championships, representing MIT, where she was studying robotics. The Jeopardy! Producers asked her about being a woman in science.
I mean, the story's been said a lot of times. I can't really add much to that spin. But meanwhile, the person next to me was like, oh, you know, I got injured in the Boston Marathon bombings, yada, yada. And I was like, okay, I'm not getting it.
But Lily doesn't just give up. When she was growing up, her dad told her stories about their family history, emphasizing all the times there was a crucial, decisive moment where things could have gone lots of ways. Nothing was ever guaranteed.
Like, the plane that my grandpa flew from Shanghai to Taiwan was so heavy, you know, just barely skimming the water, and they couldn't really, like, turn the plane or all. Like, there's so many things that happened. Even, like, my parents' story.
Lily's parents are professors who study neurodegenerative diseases. Her mom, Leanne, grew up in China and was one of the first people who got to go to college after the Cultural Revolution. Leanne went on to grad school in Iowa, where she met Lily's dad, Lee. He grew up in Taiwan.
I came to the States in 1984, and I met her 2 weeks after he reached the United States. And I said, this is it.
If my dad hadn't met my mom, he wouldn't have stayed in Iowa because he was actually kind of bored and sort of miserable there.
But since Lee did meet Leanne, he was committed to fitting into the U.S. He watched a lot of TV, like Late Night with Johnny Carson, but got frustrated when he realized he could understand all the words, but couldn't get the jokes.
And I don't know why it's so funny, right? Then it hits me that it's not language, it's culture.
That was the start of his obsession with knowing the details of American culture, an interest, he says, helped him fit in with Americans, and an interest he passed down to his daughter as a love of trivia, hence her fascination with Jeopardy.
Jeopardy is sort of like an omnipresent thing of the American cultural landscape. You would think it's weird if you were saying, like, oh, I was watching Jeopardy, and someone was like, what?
The second time Chin auditioned for Jeopardy, she played up the unexpected aspects of her personality. This is from a behind-the-scenes video.
I'm part of the trap shooting team at MIT, so that means Clay Frisbee's shooting down with a shotgun.
Chin told the producers how she loves to dance, and even danced for them.
Can you give us a little bit of a dance for us? Show us what it looks like?
Yeah. If she was dancing, I'd say, oh, you're dancing like a snake. I'm pretty sure that's why I got chosen.
First person I call is going to be in champ position, the middle, and the third position. Lily Chin!
She called me. She was very excited. She said, hey, Mom, I got on the Jeopardy finally. And I was thinking, okay, I didn't take it too serious.
We both didn't take it too serious.
So
it didn't sink in.
But fellow contestants soon were calling Chin a Jeopardy-winning machine.
Hey, Lily.
Who is Athena?
Yep. Lily?
Who's Queen Elizabeth?
Yes.
Lily just went beast mode and just destroyed us.
Lily.
What is a snapping turtle?
That's right.
American Lit, 1200.
Answer. The other daily bubble.
By the time they reached Final Jeopardy of the 2017 Jeopardy! College Championships, she was in the lead.
Astronomer who began his epitaph, I used to measure the heavens. Now I shall measure the shadows of Earth. You have 30 seconds. Good luck.
The answer is Johannes Kepler, as in the 17th century German mathematician and astronomer. Chin says she knew that. But standing across from Alex Trebek on stage, she wrote down a very different response.
I was just like completely high on adrenaline. I was just like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
Chin realized she was in a position to win no matter what. So she did what some other Jeopardy contestants have done. She used the opportunity to make Alex Trebek say something funny and to pay homage to another one of her loves, internet culture.
We come to Lily Chin, and her response, who is the spiciest meme lord? All right, let's see what your wager was. Nothing. So 20,400 today, 20,400 yesterday gives you a total of 40,800. We bumped that up to 100,000. You're the champion. Come on over here, Lily.
Yeah, Chin's answer was, who is the spiciest meme lord? It's another way of saying something like, who's the best at making interesting memes? And memes, for those who need a refresher, are images or videos people add text to or change in some way to make a commentary or joke they share online.
It's like this national television thing that you're not expecting to be in on the joke. And it's not the TV itself that's on the joke. It's a person in there subverting the system. Like, that's really interesting.
Chin's parents didn't get it.
I don't have any idea, so I have to Google it. And I don't think her dad has any idea.
No.
But lots of other people got the joke. The reaction online was immediate and overwhelming. Chin herself became a meme. The image of her standing on stage the moment her Jeopardy answer was revealed, thousands of people photoshopped it for their own entertainment.
There's a picture of Joe Biden and John Travolta kissing me. The MIT Democrats Club, they made like a silly Photoshop edit where it's like instead of who is the spiciest meme lord, it's who is the spiciest convention delegate.
As Chin puts it, people claimed her from her high school to MIT. The president mentioned her at graduation and Jeopardy used her image in ads.
So now I'm one of those forces trying to grab my own image from myself. And I have like less sway than like a national media conglomerate, it turns out.
There was a lot of online speculation about Chin. Like people openly wondered if she was a boy or a girl. Some people thought she was a supporter of President Trump because some of his supporters had gotten a lot of mainstream press for using memes. Other people assumed Chin was anti-Trump because she's Asian American.
And so they were like, wow, you know, like Trump's wrong. We have all of these children of immigrants. Like, this is what we want our college and future to be like. And I'm like, I didn't really sign off on that idea of like my image being used to fit other people's agendas. Right. Because like, crud, you don't know me. Like maybe like I'm one of the Mississippi Delta Chinese and I've been here forever, you know.
It's been more than a year now since Chin's Jeopardy win. And she seems to have come to a conclusion. The after effects of her Jeopardy stunt weren't always pleasant, but the spiciest meme lord joke opened up opportunities she wouldn't otherwise have. Chin's doctoral work in robotics at MIT has been entirely paid for by some huge fellowships. In the acceptance letter from the Hertz Foundation Fellowship, they specifically mentioned her Jeopardy win.
In the email itself, it's like, and on a more personal note, it's nice to welcome the spiciest meme lord into this fellowship community. And I'm like, you know, I thought like all the robotic stuff was pretty cool, but yeah, it's nice to be the Jeopardy girl. Yeah. Every time I talk about this, I also feel like I'm like, you know, looking the gift horse in the mouth, right? Like this would never happen if I wasn't like the Jeopardy girl. I'm going to be defined by this moment. It's not something I chose, even though I did audition, I did go through all of these things. It's not something I was consciously aware of, is probably the better way to phrase it.
So if you could tell people who you really are, what would you say?
I really don't know, I guess. I want to be known for my robotics research on my technical side. I think it would be awesome if I could get a Nobel Prize. But now I know that like when I get my Nobel Prize, like in the booklet of like my biography, it's going to be like, she's also the Jeopardy champion. So yeah.
For the World, Rupa Shenoy.
Rupa is the host of our podcast, Otherhood. You can find it on iTunes or whatever your player of choice is. Look for the longer version of that story titled The Spiciest Meme Lord Revealed. I'm Marco Werman. A U.S. corporation wants to set up a gold mine in Peru, but a grandmother lives on that land and she's not budging.
I was on my knees crying. I told them, don't do this. This is my land. I didn't sell it to anyone. Where am I going to go?
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's an old story in Latin America, outsiders coming in and taking natural resources from literally beneath the feet of the people who live there. There's a version of the story playing out right now in Peru. The American mining corporation Newmont, one of the world's largest gold producers, wants to open a new mine in Peru, but there's a feisty potato farming grandmother standing in the company's way. Tipa Fernandez reports from the Andes Mountains.
Her name is Maxima Acuña Talaya. I YouTubed her before I left for Peru. I wanted to see who she was, find some clues about this tiny lady who refuses to move off her land so Latin America's largest open pit mine can begin construction. I was warned before flying to Peru that it might be a waste of time. I might not be able to enter Maxima's land. I might not get to see her small potato fields or her mud brick home because much of it is surrounded by an imposing black fence. And even Maxima herself has to pass through a security checkpoint to get to her own land. I went anyways. Maxima had come into the nearest town of Cajamarca the day I arrived. She and I would drive back to her land together. Maybe being with her, my chances of getting past the mining company security checkpoint were better.
A veces también hasta por la raza, por la color, ¿no? Que a veces usted se ve, pero casi.
Maxima is sitting in the front seat next to her son-in-law, Elias Chavez, who's driving. Elias is telling me that when they've had visitors in the past, they've been denied entry. Because of their race, their color, he tells me. They're gringos. He's been very chatty the whole long, windy, bumpy 3-hour ride. But as we get up to the security gate, he goes dead quiet. Maxima herself is sitting erect. Her face is tense. Suddenly, the unpaved road ends, and we're crossing a bridge and arriving at a locked gate. Elias turns up the music, and then he stops the car. He gives his name to the armed security guard who peers into our car. Then Maxima identifies herself.
Maxima Cunha Talaya.
Then he looks at me in the back seat.
Deepa Fernandez.
Deepa Fernandez.
He understands my name to be Deepa Fernandez Fernandez. Two last names like Peruvians have.
Fernandez Fernandez.
He walks back to his guard post. This is it. We're so close to Maxima's home. But this one stocky man could turn us back around. Elias turns up the music more. And we wait. And then he's back with a key and opening the gate. We're through. We're on our way to Maxima's land. I thought I was relieved until I watched Elias and Maxima shed a layer of stress.
Es que, el nombre de...
More like a fat, heavy coat of stress. It just breezed out the window, and suddenly they were chatting, spirited, jovial. They were on their way home. Maxima took on the role of tour guide, pointing out the window and explaining,
"This is all now private property owned by the company. They bought it from the community. It used to be common land, which any of us could pass through."
We reach Maxima's land. She springs out of the car and practically skips through the high, wispy grass over to her home where her daughter-in-law and newest grandbaby are huddled. It's about 20 degrees colder up here and very, very quiet. After some quick cuddles with her 3-month-old grandchild, a short distance from her mud brick home are patches of dark earth. Potato plants. It's time to harvest what she needs for today's meal.
Qué interesante el color.
What an interesting color potato.
Oh yes, they are beautiful potatoes. Oh my goodness.
Son naranja y amarillo.
Orange and yellow potatoes. Never seen these before.
Yes, they are good quality and grown from the native seeds that we plant here. They just taste better. Here we live off our land. We plant, we harvest, just so we can eat. We are content. But now we have this company that just won't leave us alone.
The company she's referring to is Minera Yanacocha. It's a Peruvian mining company that is majority owned by one of the world's largest gold mining conglomerates, Newmont Mining, based in the U.S. The company put up the tall black fence that now rings Maxima's land, where she once looked off and saw her neighbors dotting the surrounding hillside. Now all she sees is a fence and emptiness. Yanacocha, well, Newmont really owns it all, except for her small plot. This is the disputed land. Potato harvesting done, Maxima and her son head over to some small springs of water. One feeds into a trench they've dug. They're splayed out on their stomachs, studying the tiny fish swimming about. I scramble around them to see what they're looking at.
Fish. They breed naturally here in this laguna. Aquí mira. There are a lot here. We eat them. They are the most delicious fish. This water comes down from the hills, from the lagoons on the hillside. And so it's pure and clean, and the animals can drink it, and they are strong and they are healthy. But if the water is dirty or contaminated, the animals, they don't grow. They die.
Water. It's key to this very rural, remote subsistence life. There are little water streams around Maxima's land. She says they wouldn't be able to live here without them. It's a very tranquil life they have here. Or it was. Maxima and her husband bought this plot of land in 1994. Then in 2010, they became aware that Yanacocha, the company that had the big mine some miles away, wanted to expand. Their mud hut, their potato patches were in the footprint of the new mine, on land the company also claims possession of.
Well, since 2011,
the company has not let us live peacefully. Early on, they said we were squatters who invaded their private property.
Then, this happened. This is video shot on a cell phone by Maxima's daughter, Isadora. It was August 2011, and Maxima says a group of men showed up to evict the family with force. In the video, you see a row of police officers in riot gear standing watch. Isadora is shouting to the police officers that they need help. She implores them to help, saying her family members have been critically injured in the beating. Maxima told me she was badly injured in the beating. Here's her recollection of that day.
Yo en ese momento yo me arrodillaba. Yo lloraba yo les decía.
I was on my knees crying. I told them, don't do this. This is my land. I didn't sell it to anyone. Where am I going to go? Where are you going to kick me out to? I am here with my children. It's my property. I have papers here, but it didn't matter. They didn't listen to me.
It all gets very technical over land ownership here. Maxima and her husband do have proof that they bought the right to possess the land. The mining company also has documentation that it bought the land itself. The company claims Maxima and her family are illegal squatters. So the company went to court to prove its rights to the land. And twice, the courts ruled in the company's favour. But then, in late 2014, a local superior court sided with the family, saying they didn't have to leave. Then, last year, the Peruvian Supreme Court upheld the lower court decision. It was a victory for this subsistence potato farmer. But both sides still claimed the land as theirs. And now the Chalpe family had Peru's Supreme Court on its side saying they were not illegally occupying the land. So, who has the right to possess the land? The issue is still pending in yet another civil lawsuit. Yanacocha did not respond to multiple interview requests. But Maxima and her family say that to this day, they're still being harassed.
Then they came after our animals, they killed my dogs, my rabbits disappeared, they killed my sheep. And from there they slandered us in public and saying whatever they wanted about us in public.
By they, Maxima means agents of the mining corporation. That's how the men are described in a lawsuit Maxima and others later filed. Now, to be clear, I can't prove what exactly happened and who did all this to Maxima. The mining company claims to have, quote, always respected human rights. All that harassment described by the family, those are totally legal and non-violent police inspections, according to the mine. For her part, Maxima went public and started speaking out. Maxima's husband, Jaime, says the company has turned their former neighbours against them, people who he says are witnesses to their ownership of the land. They bought off our witnesses, Jaime tells me. They gave them jobs at the mine, and when I went to talk to them, they told me they now work for Yanacocha and can't be my witness. I tried to verify his allegations, but community members I met who work for the mining company did not want to talk to me. Sometimes, Maxima says, it feels like the entire country is against them.
Bienvenidos de vuelta, el accionista mayoritario de Yanacocha.
Even the news in Peru seems to only report Newmont's side, rarely coming to talk to her.
Newmont es el segundo productor mundial de oro. Destacó también los
alcances. It did strike me that the Peruvians I met think the new mine will be good for Peru, and that Maxima and other indigenous farmers are just standing in the way of Peru's development. One morning, as I ate breakfast in my hotel, the diners at the next table got into a heated discussion about the indigenous resistance to mining. It's two older couples. They're talking about how the mining company is giving local people schools and a health clinic, yet they keep protesting, saying, "We want onions and potatoes and yuca." Their tone is mocking. They just don't understand why people would want to stay on their land and simply grow potatoes. The campesino resistance to mega mines is seen by some as harmful to Peru's economic development. Ronnie Camargo Diaz lives in a working-class neighborhood of Lima. He believes extracting gold is good for Peru. He used to work security for a different mine in another part of Peru. He saw up close the community resistance to his employer. He says the community made unreasonable demands of the mining company and expected it to provide them with everything, when in fact the company did help, he says. He believes the government should have provided the communities more help. And he goes on to tell me, Maxima should leave the land and let the mining begin. I asked Maxima why she doesn't just leave.
This is my land. I know this land. Why don't I want to leave it? It's because we worked this land hard. We made it productive. They tell me they'll give me another plot of land elsewhere, but then I'll have to invest $50,000, $60,000 to fix it up and make it productive. Here on my land, the work is already done. We just have to plant the seeds, and it gives us everything we could want.
She believes that while oodles of gold can be extracted by foreign-owned firms, this will never justify what she believes is violence against the natural world. The process is indeed jolting, as you can hear from explosions like this one, especially if you live right by the mine site. Entire mountains are blown up to get to the valuable metals underneath. And it's not just that huge explosion. Clouds of dust shoot up and then flutter into the air and settle on nearby homes.
Hay gente que no valoran la naturaleza, no valoran.
There are people who don't value nature. They don't value what God gave us. They are people who only want economic power and money. And they don't care about life. They want to leave nature behind and move on to some other way of living, but I don't think we should destroy the land God gave us.
These are not abstract concepts to Maxima. There are tons of mines in Peru, including a Yanacocha mine close by. Maxima has witnessed the devastation firsthand.
Porque si ha visto en Yanacocha, y ha habido una hermosa laguna.
I've seen the Yanacocha mine area. There was a beautiful lagoon there, and now it's a desert. It's a disaster.
Lagoons dried up, lush farmland turned to dust. These are the complaints of people living around the existing mine. And while the company says it's environmentally responsible, what Maxima fears most is this ecological hell coming to her farm. I'm keen to see it for myself, to see what these foreign-owned projects are doing to Peru's landscape. But to do that, I'll need to mount a horse and head high up some Peruvian mountains. More on that later. For The World, Tipa Fernandez, Cajamarca, Peru.
Tomorrow, we'll follow Tipa into those Peruvian mountains.
Come on, Blanco, you can do it. Horse's name's Blanco.
Looking forward to part two of Tipa's reporting tomorrow, right here on the show. This show is heard all across the United States on some 300 stations, but we're also an international show, and not just because we're also online. We have a weekly best of edition of The World that goes out on the BBC World Service. That show is Boston Calling, and there are some things you don't know about that show. Recently, we asked our Boston Calling listeners to reach out and let us know where exactly they're listening from. Our producer, Lydia Jean Codd, has been going through the responses. So what'd you get, LJ?
We received emails from Greece,
Sierra Leone, Trinidad, Australia, Uganda, Bali, Japan, Chad.
Any messages that really stood out for you? I mean, the representation globally is impressive, but what about just people and their thoughts?
I collected some voice memos, actually. Here's a couple.
My name is Moses Girondo. I'm talking to you from Monrovia, Liberia. I am a public health physician. During the day, I'm busy working on the health system. And then on weekends, I listen to Boston Calling. It has been very interesting.
My name is Kathy Stone. I listen to your program from Huasco, Chile. It's on the coast of the Atacama Desert, which is the driest desert on the planet.
Liberia, Chile, and I can't believe you haven't mentioned it yet. We've been getting photos from a lot of people showing us their views as they listen to Boston Calling.
Yeah, I printed some out, actually. Here's a great one from Hong Kong, if you want to look at it.
Wow. I know lots of skyscrapers in Hong Kong, but that view is extraordinary. Right out on the bay, and you see all the ships.
And then we got one from Thailand.
Oh, I remember this one. Yes, we thought there was a tiger in the picture, but it was actually a statue of a tiger. Anyway, that's also lush green mountains, very evocative.
It's a pretty convincing statue, though.
Yeah. So if you'd like to see the pictures we just talked about and lots more, we'll be posting them on our Twitter and Facebook pages throughout the day. Also, if you missed any editions of The World, Boston Calling is a great way to catch up. It's a 26-minute weekly Best of the World podcast, and you can get it wherever you get your podcasts. This is also my shot at a plug for an app you definitely must have on your phone, the BBC iPlayer app, so you can listen to Boston Calling anytime you want. It'll open up a whole new world of radio for you, the BBC iPlayer, including their music programs, which brings me to our final story today. It's about K-pop, South Korea's muscular pop sound that has turned the capital of Seoul into one of the most competitive song factories in the world. We've reported in the past about how hard it is to break into that scene as a foreigner. You might recall our story about two African-American women who learned to sing in Korean, and against the odds, they actually made it. Now meet singer Marshall Bang. He's a Korean-American from Orange County, California, who is openly gay and trying to conquer South Korea's music scene and its conservative views. Josie Hwang of KPCC reports from Seoul.
Marshall Bang sang his way onto South Korean TV last year. He was on a talent contest called Show Me the Money.
Show Me the Money 6 본선 1차 경연. 이번 대결은...
It's kind of a hip-hop American Idol. Millions of viewers may not have known it, but they were watching one of the country's few openly gay entertainers. Now, Bang is about to drop his debut EP, and he's selling his velvety voice and being a gay man.
I want to push culture forward as well, kind of like letting people know that, like, the only thing different about us is that we love different kinds of people than you. You know, that's it.
Being gay may not seem like it'd be a big deal in the land of K-pop. The industry pushes the envelope on gender bending. Feminine-looking young men are some of the biggest idols out there.
They're prettier. There's a lot more makeup. Sometimes it's androgynous, you know.
But being openly gay, that's another story. South Korea bans same-sex marriage. And last year, the government imprisoned an army captain for having sex with other soldiers.
Protesters call it a homophobic witch hunt, targeting gay soldiers within South Korea's military.
South Korea's cultural conservatism is rooted in Confucian ideology and doing what's proper, like marriage and then kids. And then there's the influence of fundamentalist Christians, a minority in Korea, but big protesters of gay rights. Bang is very familiar with anti-gay sentiment in Christianity. He grew up in a devout Christian household. In fact, his mom's a pastor at a megachurch for Korean immigrants.
Church is supposed to be a place where you can really be yourself, but because certain subjects are untouchable, being gay was one of them. I just kind of pushed everything down and suppressed it. And if anyone accused me of being gay, I would just be like, no, I'm not.
So he skipped dating and immersed himself in music, mostly Christian pop. But then in ninth grade, his friend lent him a Mariah Carey CD. You're treating me good, sweet symphony. He began to make YouTube videos singing the R&B music he loved. People were taking notice of his voice at church, at school, on the internet. But then he got sick.
I had laryngopharyngeal reflux, which is the version of acid reflux that comes up to your vocal cords and just messes it up.
So Bang put singing on hold for a few years. He moved to New York and worked as a hairstylist. But then in 2012, out of the blue, He was contacted by a TV producer who'd seen his old YouTube videos and wanted him to compete on a talent show. And soon after he landed in Korea,
my voice started to get better and better. And so I don't know if it was like a God thing or a universe thing or whatnot.
He didn't win the TV competition, but he did decide to relocate to Seoul. A career as a singer felt within reach. So did living openly as a gay man. He had already told his two younger brothers, which went well. His pastor mom, that was harder.
I spoke to my mom in Korean. My Korean was just absolutely terrible. Very like preschool-y, like, "Mom, I like boys." I think she was like kind of confused.
Bang says his mom's still processing. As to how K-pop fans will react to him, he has no idea. A survey from a few years ago showed that 57% of South Koreans find homosexuality unacceptable. But college student Hyungwoo Hong says the young people he knows don't think like that.
In our generation, like, if we can't understand gay culture, and other people say, "Why aren't you understanding them? What's wrong with you?"
For Hong, being gay doesn't hurt an artist, but it doesn't really help either. The most important thing, he says, is the music and how good it is. And for Bang, he can't wait for people to hear his. He dreams of topping the charts and selling out stadiums around the world. On the personal side, he wants a life partner. And when that day comes, he'll have another talk with mom.
My Korean is so much better now. It's like we're having full-on major conversations.
Things can only go more smoothly. For the world, Josie Hwang, Seoul. Won't you come over?
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of The World. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.